Hey, welcome everyone to the NFCast Bioinformatics Podcast, where we're discussing the latest advancements at the intersection of biology and informatics. In this podcast, we celebrate the brilliant people, we have one right here, and the companies that are changing the world through the advancements in genomics and life sciences. So our guest today is Nils Homer. He's one of those brilliant people in our second ever podcast. Nils is the founding partner at Fulcrum Genomics, and he has over a decade of experience developing methods and software for the analysis of next generation sequencing data. He's worked in both industry and academia, and he's led teams to support the largest academic genome sequencing facility in the world. He has a BA in computer science and mathematics from Colgate and a master's and a PhD in computer science from UCLA. I'm sorry about your Bruins. Nils, it's great to have you here today.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, it's going to be a lot of fun. This is our second ever NFCast, and we had a lot of fun with Phil Ewells last month. So let's kick things off. Tell us a little bit about Fulcrum and the kind of work that you do.
Yeah, so Tim Fennell and I started Fulcrum Genomics just over 5 years ago. We started out of an interest in doing something we call molecular biology debugging. So in our past lives, we've led software engineering teams, bioinformatics teams, interdisciplinary teams. And the thing we really enjoy doing is working with molecular biologists, human geneticists, engineers who are developing novel technology, assays, instruments in the molecular biology genomics space. And, really working with them to define the experiments, to implement analyses and tools, and work with them to, bring product and technology to market. And so we've done that in, the R&D space, in clinical diagnostics, therapeutics, in the pharmaceutical space. And I think, the thing that sets us apart is our willingness to learn, to have some breadth and depth across the field of genomics. And that's something we've really enjoyed over the past 5 years, is coming up to speed on all these new technologies.
Oh, very cool. Obviously we met in travels around the industry, and I think we are crossing paths in about three customers right now. So we enjoy working with you, and obviously the customers obviously have a lot of respect for you and Tim and the team's work, because we're certainly coming across you in lots of places. So let's get going. I see a lot of new grads are about to be PhDs in my work and related travels these days. Talk about the path from grad school that you've done, obviously, to bioinformatics and industry, because that can be a difficult route for many people to take in their career paths.
Yeah, I went straight from graduate school into industry. I knew I wanted to go into industry, and the things I enjoyed in graduate school were working on these new technologies. So, the Human Genetics Lab at UCLA under Stan Nelson, we got one of the first Solex instruments and one of the first solid sequencing instruments, as well as access to, a large bolus of array data, and working on those data types and developing kind of the newest tools for variant calling, for mapping, for new applications in genomics was really, really exciting. And so what set me apart there was developing tools that were useful to a broader community, software tools and methods. And that's what really led me into industry, was those two loves of developing analytical tools as well as developing technology. And I think that the challenge for folks these days is the bar is a lot higher. There's reproducible research, there's software engineering skills that bioinformaticians need, there's pragmatism. And I think, that's going to be a challenge for people going into industry. There's the bar is so much higher. I think the one thing that's different from academia than industry is pragmatism is needed. There's a lot of perfectionism in academia, whereas, there's good enough in industry. There's getting a product to market, there's showing feasibility to get the next round of funding. There's all these checkpoints that don't need perfection. And then finally, I think, we all have our favorite programming languages or workflow languages or software or tools that we like to use, but being agnostic is really important, because we're collaborating with so many different people from so many different backgrounds. But on the other hand, you have to remain opinionated. And that's something I pride myself on, being opinionated, because that's how we learn and that's how we differentiate, what's the right tool for the job at hand.
Right. It makes total sense. We're seeing that in a lot of our clients. Lots of opinions, but lots of different tools to get the job done. We've seen a lot of breakthroughs in life sciences in the last few years. It's amazing, particularly in the last year. I think we're seeing the results of a lot of this work with COVID and the vaccines, and how fast things have come to market. And bioinformatics has played a huge role in the last year, but over the last number of years, and we're seeing lots of really interesting stuff in personalized cancer therapies as well. How do you see bioinformatics evolving over the next 3 to 5 years from where it is today?
I think it's the same as it's been going on for the past decade, which is it'll advance with the technology. You know, it's a real companion to the technology. And when I first started graduate school 15 years ago, you know, someone told me, hey, why are you working on alignment? Isn't that solved? And now I see advancements in graph genome alignment. I see pan genomes coming out that require really interesting and novel bioinformatic methods. So I think there always will be a need for new software, new algorithms that, you know, folks will have to develop. You know, another area of technology is in single cell and spatial, genomics. And I think that's a place where, you know, you've seen a huge flourish of methods development and now software development to not only scale that analysis, but also, you know, provide accurate and you know, high analytical performance. Another place is, you know, high accuracy, long read sequencing, you know, with the advent of Oxford Nanopore and Pacific Biosciences, that's really something that's going to change and has been changing how we do bioinformatics. So as technology advances, you'll need bioinformatics to keep up. And so it's just more of the same, just a different place. And so we have to keep being flexible and open-minded as those things come along.
That makes sense. You mentioned a lot of these different tools and the advances and related dynamics around that. What do you see as the technical challenges for bioinformaticians today?
I see a lot of advancement and challenges around reproducible research. A lot of folks are adopting workflow languages, containers, that allow us to share our analyses and be able to reproduce those analyses. I think the next challenge with that is optimizing that for scale and throughput. You know, we now know how to do reproducible research, how to share these analyses. But I think understanding how that scales when we have many samples, big data. And I think one of the challenges is distilling that from large organizations. For example, you know, the Broad Institute with Terra, and how do we just make that available to the masses so folks who are in the smaller organizations can leverage those same insights? I think that comes through, you know, the open adoption of workflow languages and example workflows that are out there and prepackaged containers, whether that's Docker, Singularity, or through, you know, installing through Conda. I think these are real important. And then, you know, as we get to that point, we're able to start thinking about how do we utilize special compute hardware, such as FPGAs, like a good example would be Dragon, or GPUs, you know, for machine learning. And how do we start utilizing this hardware so that everybody can start to leverage these specialized computer hardware? I think right now, only the largest organizations or the folks really focused on scale and optimization are doing so, but I think that'll start trickling down to everybody in the field. You know, as I say, a rising tide lifts all boats. And I think that's what's going to happen here is we're all going to be lifted up by these efforts, these large consortium and industry efforts.
Yeah, we're seeing it. You know, I think it's well out of, you know, the really large organizations now. We're seeing lots of startups doing personalized medicine and you know, small groups or people that aren't, you know, specialists in certain areas being able to leverage things like NF Core because they can just go grab a, you know, a single cell pipeline or RNA-seq or whatever it happens to be. And leverage that without having to, first of all, to write it themselves. And plus the whole containerization thing, as you mentioned, it just allows people to kind of grab things in a packaged fashion and off they go. So we're seeing a lot more machine learning being applied to life sciences. I'm interviewing someone next week to hear about how they're using it in personalized cancer therapy. How do you see other new technologies being applied in bioinformatics, and where do you see the opportunities down the road to leverage these technologies? It's sort of related to the prior question.
Right. And I think, you know, the real answer is that we have to be flexible as bioinformaticians, right? We are the ultimate connectors and collaborators in this field. We connect the data to the biologists. You know, we need to be open but also knowledgeable in our domains, right? Biology is messy. It's ultimately, you know, not well structured. I mean, that's some of our own fault as bioinformaticians, but nonetheless, that's true. And I think, for example, machine learning, you need to know the domain and context to be able to develop these networks and, you know, gain some insight, like what is it actually finding in the data? Because that's important to understand, you know, the mechanism in biology. And so then I think that falls on is, you know, how do we as bioinformaticians leverage all of the new compute hardware, all of the new analytical methods that are built on top of that? And that could include new programming languages like Go and NIM and Rust that we use to make it a little easier to write performance software. And I think one place that I think is really important is visualization. I think this is ripe for innovation. There's a lot of folks who who are doing this right now, both in industry and academia, and just being able to visually present and interact with the data in a way that is intuitive and informative is going to be really important going forward.
Yeah, I like that point on speed and analytical performance. I think that's interesting as you sort of look forward to how this is going. You know, it's been a very batch process and takes a long time to get to time to results, but you could see it shifting to near real time as we get into emergency medicine and, you know, ICUs where you're actually want to in real time get genetic results so that you can apply a personalized medicine, or you can know how a person's going to react to a specific treatment because of their genetic background. I think that's incredibly powerful. Now you're talking about needing results in potentially minutes or seconds rather than hours and days and weeks. So that's really interesting.
I think just to follow on that, yeah, with that, you know, you say, you know, look at the NICU, the Stephen Kingsmore, what he's done over the past years with Dragon FPGA, returning results that are needed quickly to, you know, identifying sepsis. You know, that's really important, you know, to be able to see what's going on, what's in there that's causing that. And I think, you know, as you're doing, you know, surveillance now with COVID, I think there's a lot of need to get results quickly.
Yeah, absolutely. We're seeing that. I know a lot of people that are swamped right now with that surveillance on the variants because they've just had to completely shift their labs to total focus on just identifying variants and, mm-hmm. and be able to react to that. So we did a recent survey. I'm sure you saw it. I mean, we talked briefly about it before, but there's a huge bias towards the bioinformatics role in our base. And that makes sense, you know, being secondary analysis, that's where you find bioinformaticians playing a lot. But, you know, that's versus software developers or the biologists. And I've spoken to a lot of teams about those differences between software engineers and bioinformaticians. And I talked to Phil about this in the last podcast as well. But how do you look at those differences and the disparate skill sets needed for this kind of research?
Yeah, I mean, first, I was like you, not unsurprised about the academic usage of Nexflo and also, you know, the utilization of HPC, you know, versus, you know, cloud technologies. You know, that's where we came from. You know, I first worked on an SG and, you know, PBS and all those, you know, grid schedulers and local compute, terrestrial compute, if you will. And also, you know, I was unsurprised that, you know, it was bioinformaticians who are, you know, initially adopting it. We're, you know, we tend to try to go to the newest thing and try it and see, and if it works well, we're really quick to adopt it. And I think that's where bioinformaticians, you know, really grasped onto Nexflo and started leveraging that. And now with Nexflo Tower and being able to run that, you know, across multiple clouds, I think that's really important. But going back to your question about, you know, the difference in bioinformaticians and software engineers, and I think bioinformaticians, you know, immerse themselves a lot into the biology, whereas software engineers want to, you know, develop the systems that are useful for the end users. And I think, you know, that's something that there's a gradient between those. It's not, there's no black and white. It's a gradient between bioinformaticians and software engineers. And I've seen this in action where we've immersed, you know, software engineering teams into an interdisciplinary and collaborative environment with, you know, other, you know, geneticists, you know, researchers, bioinformaticians, computational biologists. You know, one of my, you know, proudest moments was, you know, at the Broad Institute, you know, bringing in teams together in the engineering platform who were, you know, pure software engineers, never took a course in biology, to folks who, you know, really, you know, needed that skill in software engineering coming from a computational biology or bioinformatics background, and then just, you know, working together, and everybody improved and the results also improved and the skill improved. So I think, you know, that shows just finding collaborators and colleagues who have the skills that, you know, can fill some of the gaps of your own. And then, you know, you can move along that gradient and figure out what do I need today? Do I need my software engineering skills? Do I need my molecular biology notebook and figure out, you know, exactly what's going on in the lab? Do I need to use my bioinformatics Swiss Army knife to analyze the data?
Yeah, Swiss Army knife, that's a great way to describe it. Hey, I want to move into my favorite part of this podcast, the rapid fire section. So I'll ask you a quick question. You give me your immediate thoughts in about a 60 second or less kind of answer. So what is your favorite book and why?
My favorite book is Stranger in a Strange Land. The main reason for that is the feeling of being an imposter, the imposter syndrome really resonated with me. You know, I think we all can feel this, you know, multiple times a day or many times a week, you know, being somebody surrounded by brilliant people, brilliant collaborators and colleagues, and seeing the work that they do, you know, you feel sometimes like you're not, worthy or not at the same level. So I think this really resonated me and but also gave me, you know, a feeling of shared experience with other folks who have this. And I think that's really important. So that book was really profound for me.
Interesting. I thought you were going the Canadian transplant in America, Stranger in a Strange Land, but you went a different way. I feel it too, dealing with brilliant PhDs all day long and be more of a computer scientist and go-to-market specialist. I feel a little out of place sometimes with all these brilliant people, but it's also somewhat comforting to know that the world is protected by all these people and these brilliant minds that are moving things forward so quickly. What do the next 5 years look like for Fulcrum?
Oh gosh, as Fulcrum, we want to stay on the forefront of technology development and working with our clients, you know, who are developing new sequencing instruments or prep instruments or assays or, you know, capture single cell, you know, all these types of things. We want to stay on the forefront of that technology development. It could be branching out to, proteomics. It could be branching out to other fields beyond just genomics. And we've done a few things like that. In terms of our team, you know, I think we will continue to grow. We've been growing kind of linearly over the past couple of years. You know, we strive to remain domain experts and being very open and willing to learn with our clients. A lot of the times something's never been done before, so it's hard to find an expert, but, you know, it's also hard to find a person to take a risk and learn with a client. So I think, you know, we're going to grow pretty linearly over the next couple of years. I think try to maintain our identity. You know, we started this business, Tim Fennell and I, as a lifestyle business, you know, do interesting problems with great people while having a great lifestyle. You know, we have families, we have interests outside of work. And I think we want to continue that culture as we go forward. I think that's going to be really important over the next 5 years.
Makes total sense. As a Canadian transplanted to the US, and I know you're sitting in beautiful Kelowna, British Columbia at the moment, but what do you see as the big difference between working in Canada and working in the States?
So I went straight to the US for my undergraduate degree. So I didn't work in Canada for too long, only a few high school jobs. But I think the main difference for me, you know, seeing my family back in Canada and being here a little bit is, the focus on, you know, earning money and kind of the overwork that's associated with that. And I think those are the main differences, where there's a little bit of, in my mind, a better balance here in Canada for that work lifestyle balance. And so I think it just takes greater discipline in the US if that's the thing you want to optimize on. I think, you know, at Fulcrum, that's something, you know, we built in from the start, in both in terms of, you know, our culture, but also in terms of our business model. You know, we're able to, you know, be successful, you know, with a 40-hour work week. And I think that's really important. And it had to be successful because I work here and I want that lifestyle balance.
Gotcha. So how do you feel about the future of remote work and with respect to bioinformatics teams?
I may have a different opinion than most, but I think the honeymoon phase is over for me for remote work. We started Fulcrum 5 years ago, and, you know, we were remote from the start, you know, both from, you know, a team perspective, as well as, you know, our clients are global. So, you know, we have to work remotely with teams, you know, both on both coasts and in different countries and different continents. And so I think, you know, the for me, what I really miss is that team aspect. And so we're looking forward to building our company local in Boulder, Colorado, so that we can be together, you know, some part of the week. I mean, we don't have to be together every day. You know, there can be norms and compromises and agreements to how much we're in. But I think having someone look over your shoulder as you're working on a tough problem or whiteboarding or just having some ad hoc interaction is really important. And that's something that I miss. And I think, is going to make us a little more successful going forward. And this is also coming from somebody who's introverted by nature, who wants to be with people. So, I think it's going to strike a balance, and everybody's going to have to find what they want and how that's going to support their work life. But for us, I think, you know, having a bit of that interaction is going to be important.
Yeah, something you said with collaborating and working as a team and actually building some camaraderie, there's a lot to that. And you do miss that working via Zoom all day long and speaking work-life balance. Boulder, Colorado is a good choice for that. How did you break into your first bioinformatics job?
Well, you know, it always starts with a girl. My girlfriend at the time had a job in Phoenix, Arizona, and I needed a job to follow her. We were both on our way to graduate school at UCLA, and I was going into graduate school for cryptography, unrelated to bioinformatics or genomics. By the way, my girlfriend at that time is now my wife of many years. And you know, I got lucky. There was someone I got connected with at the Translational Genomics Research Institute out in Phoenix, and I got a summer job there. And, you know, I was successful enough to continue that work when I went to graduate school. I got connected with Stan Nelson at UCLA, who took me under his wing, and we continued some of the work I'd done at TGen. And that really, you know, got me interested and excited about applying some of the, you know, computer science skills that I had into biology. And I don't believe I took my first biology class until, you know, second or third year of graduate school. So, you know, I had no biological training, and it showed at the start. You can kind of see that in my first couple of papers, but I think, you know, I will be forever indebted to some of the people that connected me and took me and took a chance on me at the start there.
Great. Let's do three quick questions. What is something you don't enjoy about bioinformatics work?
My work is never finished. I can never leave at the end of the day. There's always some analysis running or some, you know, tweak I can make to improve something. And so just never being finished.
Yeah, that perfection, it's elusive. Flip that around now. What is something you really enjoy about bioinformatics work?
I think the people connected to the problems. I mean, I think we're all motivated by, you know, making this world a better place, and the problems are really interesting, and it takes collaboration to do that. And I think that's what I really, really enjoy, is the interesting challenges with the interesting people.
What are your three favorite tools to get your work done?
I definitely need an IDE for software development. I'm an IntelliJ PyCharm type of person. You know, workflows, you know, whether it's Nextflow, SnakeMake, or what have you, to automate my analyses. I find more and more these days that I start automating and putting my analyses into workflow languages as an aside, just so that I can go back and understand what I've done. Perhaps I need to redo analysis, retweak something, or even reproduce it. So that's another tool. And then finally, you know, containers and reproducible builds. I mean, it just made my life a lot easier. As much as we complain about waiting for Conda to build, you know, that's changed how we install and get access to tools. And I think that's really something that's useful for me.
Yeah, it's a different world with containerization and with the tools that are available now. I think back to the problems we were trying to solve in computer science in the 90s, and we were just solving them using, you know, totally different tool set. And sometimes it was pretty ugly. And I think that's why you found so many things just hardwired in Bash and shell scripts. And well, Bash wasn't around so much then. It was born shell and C shell, but whatever, aging myself. Hey, Nils, this has been a lot of fun. I really appreciate you taking the time, and I hope the folks out there in the interweb enjoyed it. And I know you're widely followed on Twitter, and people enjoy your tongue-in-cheek humor as well. So give Nils a follow. We'll put up his Twitter handle at the end here. And again, thank you, Nils. And thank you, everyone. We'll talk to you again soon.